Hello and welcome to Spirit of Film Conversations. I'm your host, Randall Libero. We broadcast on the premier channel for Transformational Talk Radio on the Internet, Seventh Wave Network, online at SeventhWaveNetwork.com. And each week we showcase today's top independent and visionary filmmakers whose movies evoke what I call the spirit of film, which is a metaphor for the movie's magical power to transform our lives. And movie audiences today are once more being challenged by films that make them think, inspire them on deeper levels, and question the status quo. And today, we're going to be talking about what I feel is the single most important issue affecting our world today, which is the subject of global warming. And we have with us writer-director Michael Taylor, who will be telling us about his film, The Great Warming, being released nationwide in the U.S. this week, the first week of November. The Great Warming is a dramatic film about climate change that sweeps around the world, showing how a changing climate is affecting the lives of people everywhere. So, Michael, welcome to the program.
Well, thank you, Randall. Nice to be here.
Well, the global warming issue is definitely something that's beginning to really seep into the public mind on a pretty much daily basis. It's not getting consistent coverage in the news, but it's definitely something that's in the back of people's minds are beginning to know about it. So tell me what your expectations of the film is in terms of affecting people's consciousness about the issue.
Well, I tell you what our intention is to reach out to people who are not scientists and who are not necessarily conservationists, actually just to reach out to average Americans and give them some sense of what's underway in their environment and what some of the impacts are. And then after they've got a sense of what some of those impacts are, which are pretty frightening, then give them some idea of what some of the solutions might be and what they can do and what some other people in the United States and around the world are doing.
Well, I know watching the film last night, the film goes beyond other climate change documentaries and it looks at the realistic solutions and technologies and actions which people can consider to help reduce the impact of climate change. So that's why I think the film is different from documentaries that we see on TV and the movie The Inconvenient Truth that came out last year. But your film kind of really goes into a whole couple of other areas where this subject hasn't been covered yet. One of those is the subject of the evangelical social phenomenon happening and affecting the political decisions today. So can you talk a little bit about that? That's one of the most recent additions to your movie.
It is, and it's been a surprise to us as well as to everybody else, I think. About a year and a half ago, I saw an article by Laurie Goodstein in the New York Times about the evangelical upsurge in interest in the environment, and I thought, you know, that may be one of the missing elements in the show. We'd been talking to people in Washington and around the U.S. about what was required to do better films on sustainability, and they all kept saying to us, gee, if we could only get the religious right on our side. And when I saw this story, I said to my wife, who is the executive producer of the show, why don't you call this fellow Richard Cizik, who was quoted extensively in the article? Well, Karen, who's afraid of calling no one, picks up the phone and called Richard, and he turned out to be a wonderful fellow. And we followed his story up, and then I looked up some other stories, and as you saw in the film, came across a wonderful story about a former ER doctor who has given up medicine and has decided to fulfill a broader challenge by going out and becoming a religious educator, primarily within the evangelical community. And those two stories, which, frankly, Randall, are only about, I think, 6 to 7 minutes out of the entire 80-minute show, seem to have infused the rest of the show. We never intended to do a movie about religion or even bring religion into it until these stories kind of surfaced in front of us. So I'm not sure I can claim any great prescience in you know, in having chosen them, it just, I think, was a very fortunate kind of thing. And it's led us to a wonderful coalition of upwards of 30 different groups who are supporting us. And you check that out on our website. It's an amazing coalition of environmentalists and religious groups and a few business groups. And I just think it shows that there's a, all of a sudden, a much broader interest in the United States in global warming. I think it perhaps is because of the political season that you're in, but you know, we're just thrilled.
Well, that's kind of why I brought it up, because yeah. I mean, every time I turn on the news now, there's all the talk about politics, of course, in November here. But I'd like to actually kind of get back into how the film actually came to be, since
sure.
this program is geared toward people who make movies as much as people who watch them. Now, your company, first of all, if anyone is open up another browser on your computer and while you're listening to the program, and go to the website for the movie. It's thegreatwarming.com. So your production company is Stonehaven Productions Incorporated, which is a television production and communications firm based in Canada.
That's right, up in Montreal.
Right, and you have several other projects that are currently in development, but The Great Warming is a movie that is actually, it's not, it didn't have its inception recently. It's actually a few years old.
Well, I tell you, we started thinking about it and planning for it almost 6 years ago. And one of the reasons that we were able to go ahead and do it is just a combination, again, another fortuitous combination of events. One was that the Canadian government had something called a climate change fund. And I'm not sure whether there wasn't a whole lot of interest in climate change here, but they seemed to be quite willing to expend some money on this project. And it was just right after the Y2K issue, and everybody had been focused on that. And the other thing was that a very good and somewhat dense book on climate change had just come out, written by a Canadian author, and it just sort of went click and click, and we had a good book to base it on, and some funding initially, and Discovery Canada was the network that agreed to broadcast it. So we started with a three-part mini-series. For those of your audience who are filmmakers in the United States, they'll know we have one advantage in Canada that you don't have in the States, and that is that we do have some federal film funding for television, etc., partly because we're a much smaller market and can't really afford to do a whole number of documentaries without some kind of government support. So that was, all of these things kind of clicked. And as we kind of moved forward with the project, and it finally came on the air in the spring of 2004, the interest was already growing in the subject. So we've been very lucky in that this film has evolved as has interest in global warming and less fortunately some of the nasty events of global warming at the same time. We then did partially based on this miniseries, we did a one-hour PBS special, which ran last November. And at that time, around that time, we started thinking, gee, this might have some theatrical possibilities. It was shot widescreen to begin with and by excellent, excellent camera crews. And it was a great-looking movie. And as we scouted around, we found increasing interest in some of our sponsors, our corporate sponsors and government sponsors said, well, if you can do it, go ahead and try. We'll give you a few bucks to turn it into a feature. So that's kind of where it was. Now, the last year has been just a tremendous frenzy of activity trying to get a movie put together and into theaters. It's as any of your filmmaker listeners will agree that this is a tough business.
Yeah, well, I completely agree with you. We talk about distribution in different ways that people are getting their films out there, whether yeah. it's through a limited theatrical release and regionally, or four-walling it, or going going around the country and sort of like a road show. I mean, there's all different ways of, and now the internet, people are premiering movies on the internet, like
yeah.
The Secret, which we talked to the producers a few weeks ago.
Right.
So that's a whole other thing. Well, I want to get into now what's in the movie. I mean, people have been who want to know about more about the subject. From the beginning, was your objective to create a sort of a new kind of climate change show, one that would not rehash the tired old debate about whether or not global warming is real, but basically more that begins from the premise that it acknowledges the reality and the threat of global climate change, and to a film that would just get past the debate and start talking about what we can do? Was that your intention with the movie?
Our intention was never to touch the debate. And in fact, and I have to make the point that being a Canadian producer, our government and our population are well aware of climate change and have accepted the fact that it's there, and there's no debate in Canada, there's no debate in Europe or Great Britain, no debate in hardly anywhere else in the rest of the world. So we never thought of it being a debate. We weren't interested in the skeptics. They'd already been dismissed by most of the people that we respected. So it was really a kind of classic something's lurking, we have to do something about it, and here are the solutions kind of story arc. And it wasn't a whole lot more complicated than that. What people kept saying to us is, you can't do this, it's too big a subject. You've got to have personal stories that have to run all the way throughout. We thought, this is an awfully big story to do that way. So we, perhaps being a little naive, didn't do it the way that the television broadcasters asked us to do it. We simply... as you have seen in the film, Randall, we simply started telling the story and tried to illustrate it with anecdotal evidence and good interviews and images from all around the world, and based it on known science at the time. And it's sort of proceeded from there. Now, as we got a little farther into it, we started finding the human stories, particularly in the impact side. The science side of it, we didn't belabor a whole lot because, from our point of view, it was pretty well accepted. Once we started getting into the impact side and the solutions, then we started finding individual people who were doing or being affected by climate change. I mean, people not only in North America, but people in Bangladesh and people in Mongolia and people in Europe. And that's where it got a little more human and a little more anecdotal. But I'm a great believer in good anecdotes telling a story that the public can understand. Then I'm rambling here, so jump in.
Okay. All right. Well, there's a couple of issues that the film kind of breaks it up in a very easy to understand and easy to follow manner, because you kind of explore one issue at a time and look at personal stories, as you just mentioned. And then there's also some reflection from the scientist backing up, the particular area you're talking about. And the first one that you look at in the film is actually that the Earth is warming up considerably and has been for over the past century. And that we're in the warmest period that we've been for supposedly even thousands of years, and that has accelerated the process of global climate shifts in various areas. One of them that you talk about extensively in the film is about the rise in actually the sea level on its effect on coastlines.
Yes.
And effects on economies and lifestyles and all of that. Can you talk a little bit about that part of the movie?
Well, I think it's if there's any data that's pretty well agreed upon by everybody, it's that the that the warming has increased significantly. And in fact, it's one thing I have to add parenthetically is that the warming looks like it's increasing at a faster rate than was projected, let's say, five, six years ago by the computer models at that time. So the warming is increasing. The glacier melt in America is basically removing virtually all significant glaciers within North America. I mean, they're projected to be pretty well gone from Glacier National Park by 2030. Greenland is the acceleration of water flow out from Greenland is a threat.
Greenland is actually becoming green.
Parts of it are. I mean, it's getting back to a period similar to the years around, in the so-called medieval warm period.
Right.
But and the skeptics are saying, yes, but there's more snow. Well, that doesn't matter. That doesn't decrease the runoff coming from the glaciers. So the Greenland certainly has a significant interest or impact on sea level rise, that amount of water coming in, as does what looks like is happening in the Antarctic. What most people forget, though, is that a huge amount of the warming, at least of the sea level rise, is caused by a warming of the oceans, and the oceans have warmed significantly, upwards of a full degree centigrade over the past few decades. As water warms, it expands, and as it expands, it rises. There are certainly arguments as to whether it's going to be 18 inches by 2050 or 36 inches by the turn of the next century. The simple fact is that it's very likely that there's going to be noticeable sea level rise of at least a couple of feet in the foreseeable future.
Right, I'm already seeing news stories over the past several years, because I used to write news about some of the even islands around the Florida Keys disappearing. That's one of the things that start. I mean, they're getting smaller, and also there's a lot of stories about the ice caps melting, especially around the South Pole, with the Ross Ice Shelf and things of that nature. And then, but in the film, you talk about the North Atlantic current in the ocean.
Yes.
And the other aspect of that part of the film is you can actually have, and this is what people are kind of in a quandary to understand when I ask them about it, is that you can actually have global warming, but you can have drastic temperature shifts that seem colder in certain areas of the world. Can you talk a little bit about that aspect?
Well, I certainly don't have any projections for sudden cold snaps. Skating on the Thames River, which was one of the images I think that was pushed by a number of people a few years ago. However, in the past, I know, for example, in Greenland in the Arctic, there is evidence from ice cores of dramatic drops in temperature, upwards of 10 degrees centigrade, which would be whatever the dickens that is, about 18 degrees.
Yeah, over even a couple of decades.
Yeah, no, over as little as 2 years.
Two years.
A friend of mine, Dr. Paul Majewski, who heads the Climate Change Institute at the University of Maine, headed up one of the Greenland drilling teams most recently, and their evidence shows drops of, as I say, 10 degrees Celsius in as little as 2 years. I mean, that's just terrifying. Now, that's in the Arctic, and that wouldn't be as great as we move farther south.
But
I don't
that's
think
still
we're gonna,
significant.
Sorry again.
That's still significant, though.
Yeah, that's pretty cool. That's a nasty day, especially for you folks down there in Phoenix, I guess. Boy, that'd cut a lot of golf games out. But I think there is now the debate is if there is a debate, it's how the warming of the cooling is going to play out. There seems to be sort of a balance now of people who originally thought that Northern Europe would freeze to death. the simple fact is that the global warming effect, the greenhouse effect, is likely to keep warming occurring, even if there is a drop off in the warming effect of the Gulf Stream. So we're not going to have, as they say, Buckingham Palace in London is not going to be covered in snow, I don't think, very soon.
Right. Well, we're already seeing the result in recent memory, of course, of intense weather conditions, especially storms, heavy snowfalls, flooding. I mean, that's a reality we've already witnessed on our watching national and local news.
Mm.
But there's another issue which was brought up to mind, is that if you think about the Earth itself, once you have sea level rise, say there's more ice caps melting and there's more water, one thing that wasn't covered in the film is that when you have more water, it actually has an effect on the tectonic plates of the Earth, which could cause earthquakes and volcanoes.
Well, I would never go quite to the tectonic plate movement, but you may well be right. I'm not sure. The one thing I wanted to say about the sea level rising is that as it rises, the storm surges appear to be getting worse. So it may not be that extra foot that's rising along the Chesapeake Bay area. It's the potential storm surges that will get more and more significant. And you can see that in the impacts of Katrina and on New Orleans.
Yeah, most definitely. One of the other issues that was a big indicator to me of how we're really affecting the atmosphere and the development of countries that are now moving into what the kind of lifestyle that we enjoy in the United States was the changing of lifestyle and energy use in China and India.
Yes.
Which was, when I saw that part of the movie, I just shuddered, because when you think about those countries are both areas of the world where there are huge populations, and more people putting more CO2 in the atmosphere in a shorter period of time as their lifestyles change, that is definitely going to have a significant impact. Could you talk about that part of the movie?
Well, what's interesting there is that both the Indian people and the Chinese people, and there's a great gross generalization, are very active and ambitious and very bright people, and they're moving very, very quickly. You know, when you get different projections about how quickly the heavens are going to part and we're all going to be doomed. But the simple fact is that yes, the amount of energy that both of them are going to require, and China is I think well ahead of India at this particular point, but the amount of energy they're going to require is incredible. And it looks like an awful lot of it's going to come from coal, unless something drastic happens technologically. I think the Chinese, from what we understand, the Chinese are well aware of this at the at the headquarters of the party in Beijing. But it's getting that message out to the regional governors who also have economic targets that may be more important to them than their climatic or environmental targets. I think that's a real, really serious threat to all of us. Don't quite know what to suggest about that.
Well, we're going to talk about solutions in the movie in just a bit, but one of the other areas that I saw that was an education was the health issues as a result of global warming and emergence of new diseases.
Yep.
There's a point in the film where one gentleman says that over the last 2.5 decades, 30 diseases that are new to medicine have been discovered.
That's right. That's Dr. Paul Epstein of Harvard University's Climate and Health Center, and he's a leading world expert on that. I think one of the things that he had also mentioned is that not only are there 30-odd new diseases, there are appear to be recurrences of some old diseases that we thought we'd conquered. And Now, whether you can attribute these directly to climate change or some of it to pollution, that I'm not sure. And, you know, we don't have time in a relatively short film to go into all the details, but clearly climatic change is having some impact, simply in terms of, let's say, insect infestation moving northwards from the equator or southwards, depending on which part of the world you live in. And I guess the other aspect is the pollution aspect, which is contributing both to the greenhouse effect and also to just a horrendous increase in things like asthma, respiratory diseases, and so, you know, it's. And then there's one other thing too that we didn't have a chance to bring out in this film, and that is that as the climate changes, it's changing certain seasonal patterns, not necessarily increasing the heat tremendously, but for example, in Colorado a couple of years ago, changes in seasonality left certain kinds of mosquitoes in certain kinds of ponds in on the Front Range area of Colorado, and increase the occurrence of West Nile virus. Now, it wasn't pure heat. It was a change in the climate and a change in the precipitation. And we interviewed one of the senior doctors in Greeley, Colorado, who said that his impression was that there were upwards of 250,000 cases of West Nile virus, many of them so mild that people didn't report them. It was just a cough or a, you know, scratchy throat. But that's a pretty terrifying thought when you think what it might be if it happens again and people are a little more susceptible to it. So climatic change is a health threat as well as just the warming itself.
Right, and you had got into a little bit about the farmlands and agriculture, that our modern agriculture and the way that we farm today internationally is affecting the climate change as well. That definitely is having an effect, as not only in terms of traditional farming, but also as we bulldoze forests into farmland, especially in South America around the Amazon.
That's pretty scary, and I think there is a movement recently within Brazil. I just read something about this within the last couple of weeks, that there is some kind of movement to, you know, to put a stop to that, some sort of threat that we're not going to buy any more of your soybeans from land that has been recently bulldozed. Now, I'm not sure how they're ever going to reinforce that, but certainly there's an awareness of that issue. In North America, I think the destruction of forests is probably relatively limited. The thing that's happening within North America is the expansion of cities, the sort of sprawl of cities, and that does have an impact on climate and runoff, etc. So
yeah, I noticed here in Phoenix, as they've been planting more trees, it's been more humid this year. The city's bigger, there's more, you know, foliage, so it's feels more humid. It's not dry heat, as we joke about so much, that it's becoming more humid. And I noticed this year especially, we had a very hot year here, and it felt definitely more humid than it was in the past 5 years that I can remember.
Well, I want to tell you, Randall, we're waiting with open arms up here in Canada, and there's welcome mats laid out all the way from British Columbia to the Maritime Provinces for you people. It's, you know, all of those folks that moved to the Sun Belt years ago, we're just saying, come on back. And
well, one of the other pieces of the movie that was really impactful when the doctors started talking, we're talking about the spread of new diseases and the spread of existing diseases and the increasing respiratory ailments, especially among children.
Yes.
Who seem to be in some cases more susceptible, whether it's reasons genetically or just, for environmentally or so forth. And, one of the doctors there really, he was thinking about his children, and maybe 10 years from now, when things are very likely to get worse in terms of climate change. And he says, his child asking him was, "Dad, why didn't we do something?
Yes.
What, we had all the information. We knew it was real. What? Why didn't anybody do anything?"
Well, he's a wonderful guy, and he really is very sensitive to this problem. I think he's probably committed his career pretty much to that area of medicine. The doctors are aware of it. I stopped two women doctors after they'd screened a preview, I think in Burlington, Vermont. And I said, "Are you two doctors seeing anything? Are we being absolutely accurate and honest in what we're suggesting about climatically induced diseases?" And they both agreed. One was a pediatrician. I think the other was a may have been an ER doctor as well. And they both agreed that yes, there certainly was a distinct increase over their careers. So we're really talking maybe 15 to 20 years that there's been an increase in diseases that are related to the atmosphere and to the air that people are breathing. You could argue that you could have no warming at all, but just more pollution, you might have the same diseases. But look, the simple fact is that they're pollution and warming are going hand in hand, and it's affecting the health of the nation.
Yeah, well, definitely. And as the cities continue to sprawl out, I mean, it's one of the other issues that you explored a little bit in the film was the usage of water in municipal infrastructure in these cities. Especially, we're seeing a lot of that here in Phoenix. I always, as they build new developments, I'm always thinking to myself, where the heck are they getting the water from?
Well, I just flew back from Los Angeles a couple of days ago, and I looked down and I could see kind of a sorry looking Colorado River and very clear indications over Lake Powell of the dropping water levels there.
Lake Powell's less than half full.
Yeah,
that the way it used to be. I mean, we've had some good rain this year, but it definitely is not bringing it up to anywhere near the way it was before.
No, and I know that one of the people that we interviewed was the chairman of the Southern California or the Metropolitan Water Board of Southern California.
Yeah, that was Wes Bannister. Yeah,
wonderful guy, and very concerned about where they're going to get the water. And but the one point he made, and this kind of gets into the solutions thing, and it's parallel in nearly all the other areas of problematic areas, and that is, if we were a little more efficient, if we didn't water our lawns as egregiously as we appear to be doing in many parts of many of the warmer parts of the U.S., we could cut our water use by 50%. That's the personal water use by 50%. That's a huge amount of saving. And I think that's probably going to be necessary when you take a look at the projections for reduced snowfall in the Sierra Nevada, which supplies so much of the water to Los Angeles and I believe to San Francisco. They're in a very threatened position, and as we said in the film, desalination may be one option, but desalination requires staggering amounts of energy. So unless you're using solar energy or wind power to create that desalinated water, you're contributing to the problem. So it's a tough problem they're facing.
Yeah, there's way too much lawn watering going on here in Phoenix, let me tell you. I think when they build new developments, they should just put AstroTurf down and call it a day.
That's right. Or we could ship you some of our snow.
Well, luckily, we had an ice storm here a few years ago, but I don't think we're going to get the snow at any time soon.
We love hearing that. But Phoenix struck by snow and ice, and then we were all sitting chortling,
Yeah. Well, I grew up in upstate New York, so I know what snow and ice is.
Let me
tell you. Well, anyway, getting back to the next point in the film that you bring up, In the as we get past the looking at municipal, the use of water, one of the things that people don't really look at in terms of climate change on it often is the effect on the food chain, especially from oceans. And there's a lot of towns all over the world that depend on the commerce from local fishermen.
Yes.
What do you think is going to be some of the first really significant economic impacts that we might see from global warming?
Well, I think what we're seeing them here on the East Coast, and I guess all the way right from Boston right up to Newfoundland, and that is that some of the fisheries have basically dried up. The cod fisheries gone. The West Coast salmon fisheries are in real dire straits. So, you know, that affects the fishermen and the fish plants. But beyond that relatively small population of people who are all pretty entrepreneurial, tough people who I guess can ultimately find other work, there's just a drop-off in the food supply and an important aspect of our food supply. So I think that's a very serious problem, perhaps more serious than the impact on local fishing communities. I don't mean to sound cavalier about that, but I think the lack of food may be.
Well, it's also the shifting of the growth of marine life, and that's one part of it, which is affecting the fisheries of the world. But also, we were just talking about the use of water, and as areas become more on the side of deserts, especially here in the Southwest, as it become more drought, there's less farmland, requires more water,
yeah.
And that definitely is going to change, you know, the economics of certain areas. Let's start to get into, there's one more area that you touch on in the film. It's probably the area that's most in people's minds right now is the subject of oil. Now, there's a gentleman in the film who talks about, you know, when he thinks is going to, the mindset is going to change. He's the chairman of the Climate Institute, for the perceptions to change of people who are in positions of power to do something in terms of transitioning into sustainable energy, sustainable fuels, technology development for cars.
Mm-hmm.
What do you see, the possibility, you actually present a couple of solutions in there, of things that are being developed in terms of technology. What is presenting itself as a couple of the really viable solutions for changing the way that cars are manufactured today?
Well, I guess the obvious one is the hybrid technology that's being used by Toyota and Honda and now Ford. In unfortunately, numbers that are perhaps too small to make a gigantic impact. I think that's one major thing. The hydrogen cars that we talk about in the film are quite spectacular in that they're totally silent and much quicker than you would ever expect them to be. I've driven in one in California, and it's quite wonderful. However, it's $1 million per car. And although it's not difficult to make the hydrogen fuel takes more fossil fuel energy to produce than the hydrogen generates by itself, if you see what I'm talking about. So there's this huge question of alternative energy sources.
Because it would require, for hydrogen, it would require an infrastructure build-out across the country, unless they develop a way that people can make it themselves at their own residential location.
I've seen one of those units. I've actually seen one of those units. It's the size of a refrigerator and sits in your garage. And you literally screw the garden hose into it and turn the power on, and by the morning it's got enough hydrogen to fill your car and
that's something you should put in the next version of the film that you
actually
make in part two.
we have it in the extended version of the three part series that we did. It's just some things are just too darn hard to to stick in. But again, those things are, when you look at the cost of them, they're still extremely expensive at this stage. So, you know, there is people talk about the huge cost of the infrastructure. I'm not so sure about that. I say not so sure because I'm not a scientist or an oil man, but I have a feeling that it's really a problem of where does the energy come from to turn water and or other materials into hydrogen.
Right. How much I think the term is embodied energy. How much? Something like that. How much it costs to actually create new forms of energy to run things.
That's right. 2 gallons of gasoline to create 1 gallon of hydrogen isn't really a very good deal. Not a good deal.
Yeah. So, but definitely, I think there's increasing pressure on our political leaders because of the issues having to do with international relations and terrorism. That is, having them really take a hard, serious look at getting us out of the oil business into something that's definitely more sustainable, something that we're not going to have to send our military troops over to make sure that we have an adequate supply enough in this country.
Yeah, but isn't it terrible that it takes terrorism to stimulate political leaders to start thinking about this problem that science has known about and been warning about for years and years? Isn't it terrible that it takes something like the tragedy of 9/11 and the continued war in Iraq and elsewhere to get them to start thinking this way?
Yeah, well, and it always comes down to when people are dying, then somebody's going to do something.
I suppose.
Well, unfortunately, that I think films like yours are a terrific. It works to change people's consciousness, and that's really what the reason I do this program and feature people like yourself, because I want to communicate to the world that, you know, we can use the media in a very awakened way to talk about the serious issues that are going on in the world today. So I congratulate you and support you in your quest to get this information out to the world.
Thank you.
The next part of the film, and something that was a terrific, I just smiled afterwards, was a gentleman that's building a sustainable housing.
And different, Chris Holmes.
Yeah, talk a little bit about that part of the film.
He's a terrific young guy.
Can you talk a little louder?
I sure can.
Okay.
He's a terrific guy and a young architect. Not as young as when we filmed him. He actually is, I guess, about 30 now. And he's on his third major project. The first one, just for the information of your listeners, is one that he built in a working-class area in Montreal. It was a condominium-style building of about 8 units of 1,500 square feet per unit. The thing that was most fascinating to us was that, and he has proof of this, they have the first year's bills for it, each unit only paid $75 for the entire year's heating and cooling and hot water. Now that's pretty astonishing. I think the price may have crept up in his second and third units to maybe about $100 a year. But most of us up north, or I guess in places like Phoenix and Tucson, are paying that, more than that, per month.
Definitely.
To cool our places. So it's possible. He's using something that I think is perhaps one of the great next answers, and that is geothermal energy. I know that the latest project of his, which is in Ottawa, they have drilled down into this relatively normal-sized lot, about 42 drill holes down upwards of 400 feet each, and those drill holes will be basically, as he says in the film, is stealing heat and stealing cool from the earth, and using it instead of using fossil fuel generated energy. So you can you know, basically, if you're sitting on top of your one of your energy sources, that's pretty exciting, and the costs just drop precipitously.
Right. That's definitely something that can be put together anywhere in the world. We're on top of the earth wherever we go.
Anywhere.
Yeah,
anywhere.
And another thing which I've seen, I did a video years ago on natural building. And using materials such as natural materials such as straw
sure.
bales, and earth and rammed earth, and even over I don't know if there's any houses up in the Canadian area, but certainly over in Europe, using a cob, which is a mixture of sand and straw and clay all mixed together, and it hardens up like cement. So there's all sorts of options, and I think I'm glad that your film brought up the aspect of sustainable housing. Because there's some homes down here in Phoenix, and matter of fact, we helped some friends up in Flagstaff build a home that was literally made out of straw bales on the walls that were plastered. They're stacked like bricks.
They're terrific.
And and they have radiant heat in the floor.
They
love it because their energy savings are tremendous. They burn one log in their wood stove and it heats the house for 2 days.
Yeah.
So I think changing the way that we build homes is definitely would be a significant step because the housing industry is really driving the economy right now in the United States. And if we could use some of the ideas that are explored in your film into building modern residential houses and figure out a way to do that in communities, that would be a huge significant step in terms of energy consumption and the burning of fossil fuels.
Well, I think I agree entirely, but I have a number of friends now, people like Chris Holmes, who was featured in the film, and others who are working on things like green roofs and that sort of thing. And they're tearing their hair out because they say it's so difficult to convince a developer or a contractor or even the plumber who's working on the site that there are new ways of doing things. These folks are getting well paid for their products, building them the same way they built them for the last 40 or 50 years. And the stimulation, the urgency to change just ain't there. And so changing the minds of these people is very difficult. I remember interviewing a fellow was head of the American Home Builders Association out in Santa Fe for another aspect of the of another film, and I said, I guess these homes that you fellows are building out here, which were pretty ecologically sound, I said, I guess it's mainly young people. He said, oh, no, young people aren't interested at all, because young people are almost never buying their final home. He said, it's the people 50 and older who feel that maybe they've contributed to the global warming or pollution or whatever. They're the ones that want to do the right thing. They're the ones who want to save the money that a good green home, a straw bale home, or a solar heated home would produce. So that kind of surprised me.
Well, that's why I think films like yours need to get out there, and the public needs to see them because that and get them in schools too.
I think that's if we get them in schools, that's a tremendous thing. We've been lectured to by 16-year-old high school students for not having enough solutions in the film. They kind of wagged their fingers at us and said, you know, you've got to tell us what to do. And the other group, interestingly enough, that is the most emotionally moved by the show are women of a certain age, let's say women over 50, who have children and maybe grandchildren. They seem to be extremely both disturbed and energized by this story. I think they see that this is something maybe that they can work on. So this has all surprised us.
Well, definitely. I think as the film gets out there, I think talking about solutions just about half your film is about solutions.
It's the last,
yeah, the last
40%. Yeah,
right.
And it is basically our next project. Whether it'll be in theaters or not, I don't know. it's too soon to say, but I think the next thing is probably about solutions.
Right.
And can I just add one thing?
Sure, go ahead.
For the PBS version of this show that we did, I interviewed Amory Lovins, who's a very prominent thinker and consultant. And he made a very interesting point. He said that the public can change things like global warming and effects on the environment by the choices that they make every day. You know, the things that you buy, the services that you consume, the way that you vote, the kind of television programs that you watch.
Right.
He's saying, you know, you can make choices because he said industry is listening. And I thought, well, gee, that's obvious. And then I thought, well, I hadn't heard anybody say that before. You know, it's true. Industry and business and political leaders are listening. I think that's what's happening now with this global warming thing.
Yeah, well, definitely as it stays in people's consciousness, and you get past the point of them being scared about the issue, like, what do we do with this huge thing and the world's going to end and that kind of a, you know, mindset, as you go into more of the solution and saying, you know what, we can do something about this, even in the short term. Here's something. Right.
And locally.
And locally.
That's the thing that I think that solutions will come out of the cities and the regions of North America rather than out of your federal government or our federal government, who are just, I think, flummoxed by the whole thing. So.
Well, I know here in Phoenix, the city of Scottsdale, they have a pretty interesting group, which is part of their environmental board, which is building the municipal buildings in the city of Scottsdale.
Terrific.
That are there. I'm going to contact them and get them to take a look at this film, and you might have some possibilities in some of the things that they've done here in Phoenix. You might want to take a look at that.
Next, but then I have a good reason to visit Phoenix.
Yeah.
I'm always looking for reasons to get out of the cold.
Well, I'll send you that information by
Please
email.
Do. Please do.
Now that we're coming, we're starting to come to the end of the program here.
Yep.
What are your plans in terms of getting more information in this area and your future projects with Stonehaven?
Well, you're talking about our future plans
for this film and right,
because
you have a couple of things. You have one film that's going to be talking about the glaciers.
We have one called Secrets of the Last Glaciers, and it's a tricky sell, frankly, because it's considerably more scientific than the Great Warming, and it's one of its premises is that the southern hemisphere, where our where the first two episodes of the show have been shot, is cooler than the northern hemisphere, partly because it's oceans. And what no one knows yet, and this is one of the scary aspects of climate change. No one knows what's going to happen as the southern hemisphere warms, and you know, nature tends to want to balance itself out. So if you have a cool bottom and a hot top, you know something's going to happen. So that's one of the shows. But the other one that I'm most interested in is one on specific kinds of solutions that people can use and maybe not just something that we do, but trying to pull together videos and or internet pieces that we can make available to people to cover all sorts of things that they can do. I think that there's got to be in the next few years a huge change in the way that people live, and I think for any government to say, as I've heard both yours and ours say, this isn't, you know, quote, it's not really going to change your lives, folks. Well, I think it is. I think it's going to make a huge, I think we're going to have to make huge changes in our lives and the way we operate. Otherwise, we're in very, very serious trouble.
Yeah, well, as there's more occurrences of things like Hurricane Katrina and, yep. and the suffering that went down in New Orleans, and that happens in other ways, and God help us if we have a volcano here in North America, but you never know. I mean, just earth changes will definitely get people's attention in more ways than one, whether if they come from weather or whatever method yep. that nature decides to throw at us,
right.
and we're going to have to deal with it, and then that's going to definitely affect our economy. But the other part, which is really hopeful, is seeing, even after response of things like September 11th and Hurricane Katrina, is that people really come together. People amazingly come out of the woodwork. They're sort of, their hearts open, and they travel huge distances to come and contribute and make a difference. And I think that aspect of wherever disaster happens, whether it's abroad or Europe and Canada or South America or the United States, that is what I think is going to save the day, is just the humanness of helping others who are suffering because of climate change. I think that's going to become something that's going to be a major shift in our perceptions about who we are as a species and as human beings and as a society.
Well, I think you've hit the nail on the head, and it's the moral component of this issue that's been treated as a scientific environmental movement or issue for too long. It's now people are starting to see that there is certainly a huge moral component to it, and let's hope that they react to it.
Well, Michael, I really want to thank you for being on the program today. I appreciate your time. And everyone, go to thegreatwarming.com. That's the website where you can find out more information. Michael, thanks again.
It's a real pleasure.
And I hope to see you if you get down here at some point and travel to Phoenix and find out what's happening.
I'll be there.
All right. Well, that's a wrap for our show for this week. Join us again next week as we showcase the very best in movie entertainment that inspires us towards positive change and honors the belief that simple choices can change the world. You can find out more on the Internet about Spirit of Film Conversations and the movies we talk about each week by going to my website at spiritoffilm.net. And please tell your friends about where to find our program right here on SeventhWaveNetwork.com. And remember, you are the writer, producer, director, and star of your own movie that's called Your Life. So make it a blockbuster, and it'll be a classic. Until next time, I'm Randall Libero for Spirit of Film Conversations. We'll see you next week.